Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to what is the third episode of the Downstairs Care Out There podcast. Today we're coming to you from a small cafe just outside Central Station in Sydney, so I do apologise for some of the background noise. The reason I'm in the city and not recording at my usual home location today is that I've got Aidan with me here. You may know him from Twitter as A Little Medic, and he's here to talk to us today about some of his amazing experiences overseas. Aidan, could you just introduce yourself?
Sure. Hey Mitch, it's Aidan from Little Medic. Thank you so much for having me here today with you. Really honoured to be on the Downstairs Care Out There podcast.
Thanks for being our first guest. Up until this point, it's just been me talking away to myself.
That's right. I'm a first year student paramedic at the University of Tasmania campus in Sydney at Rozelle.
Wonderful. Congratulations on that.
Cheers. Really great course. Fantastic educators. Yep.
Good. Lots of sim?
Lots of sim. We spend at least 3 hours a week in the sim lab.
Wonderful, because we all know how passionate I am about simulation. First of all, onto Smack, where I first met you.
Yes.
So we met in the hallway briefly there for maybe 5 seconds, I
Absolutely.
Think it was.
Absolutely. Smack was intense, to say the least.
I think your phone probably has no screen left after Smack.
You know what? My iPhone's slowly dying, but thankfully I had an iPad, a new iPad, just to keep me on top of
just
things.
Just to burn through the screen, basically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you got to do it.
Yeah. 3 screen protectors later and Smack was well chronicled. So how did you start in all this? I mean, I've seen your blog, I've seen you on Twitter, but there's not really any mention as to how you kind of got into the whole foamed movement.
Yeah, I guess I was a bit of an oddball in that I actually got in while I was in high school. I was probably 16, 17 at the time. And I first started out reading paramedic blogs. So stuff like The Happy Medic, EMS 2.0, kind of got in through the EMS side of things, and slowly, I guess, graduated onto foam. With Life in the Fast Lane, definitely when Minla Kong started out blogging on the pre-hospital and retrieval medicine podcast blog, started out with that and just got hooked.
Wonderful. And once again, I'll just say Min's a huge supporter of this show, not only spruiking me on his own Twitter, but also on the pre-hospital medicine blog, which is absolutely amazing. His support for FOMED and his continued contributions just amaze me. Also, his ability to be on Twitter basically 24 hours a day.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think he's kind of hooked into Twitter like Neo is to the Matrix.
I actually saw your meme the other day. That was quite funny.
Yeah.
I think Tim Lewenberg posted that up. That was quite good.
Tim and I had a good laugh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so on to Nepal.
Yeah, so instead of doing the right thing and studying throughout my last year of high school, you know, what a marks anyway.
I mean, who hasn't blown off their HSC to just duck over to Nepal for a few minutes? And
yeah, so I spent a lot of time looking at different opportunities to kind of volunteer overseas. I really wanted to get out, kind of test myself, try myself in a foreign environment, I guess. And on page 12 of Google, would you believe it, I found this tiny little clinic called the Chisan Clinic in the middle of nowhere in Nepal. I flicked an email off to the guy, Dr. Devendra Karki, who set up the clinic. Just a wonderful guy. And he got back to me and we Skyped a bit. And yeah, I just thought, this is where I need to go.
Look, I think they're probably amazed someone found them on page 12 of Google. You've got to be pretty determined to get to page 12.
Yeah, that says it all, doesn't it?
I think that's about the point of desperation I hit an assignment where I'm like, there's got to be something for this. Come on.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, their website's actually a lot better now. It's chisanclinic.org.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So, do you recommend that people go and do that, or...?
Look, I mean, I went in there looking at different opportunities. There's the traditional save a child in Africa, go volunteer, spend 2 weeks shadowing a doctor in a sub-Saharan African hospital and pay, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 to $4,000 even for the experience, whereas I didn't really feel like that would be a valuable contribution or experience kind of thing.
I mean, on that, yours looked fairly hands-on. I mean, yeah, a lot of your stories and your photos show that you really weren't an observer there. You weren't quite shadowing. You were...
No.
Really getting involved.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be working under a physician. It turns out that there actually isn't a physician there. There's a nurse practitioner. They have a rural healthcare model where clinicians train for 3 years in a degree as a health worker. And so it's halfway between a nurse and doctor kind of nurse practitioner. It's mid-level clinician model. So they're prescribing about 50 to 70 meds and doing suturing. And that's the mainstay kind of clinician that you have in these rural clinics.
Is that an internal training program, or do they run that were you finding that the nurses were mostly from out of country or had been educated out of country, or does Nepal actually run their own training?
In Nepal, they do have nursing colleges or healthcare worker colleges there, yeah.
There you go. Now, how long did you spend over there?
So, altogether, I spent a month there, just over 3 weeks itself in the actual clinic, which was just phenomenal. I mean, it's just the most beautiful country. People really don't understand how wonderful the people are there, how giving, generous, and the countryside's awesome. I mean, you know, Nepal is a hotspot for tourism for a good reason. There's just the most phenomenal sights. You know, the 1 hour flight in this tiny little jet that fit, you know, like 20 people, flying from Kathmandu, the main city, out to Biratnagar, which is a little city of 500,000 people. Relatively little.
Half.
Yeah, you know. This tiny, rickety little plane, looking at the Himalayas out of the window, you know, just what a sight, yeah.
At that point, you must have been so close to the pilot that you'd be able to figure out if he was using a checklist or not.
Yes, well.
Do we not talk about checklists anymore?
Yeah, you know what? Maybe it's
we'll just stay.
It's too soon.
We'll
it's
just
too
stay
soon.
Away from yeah. that. We'll stay right the hell away from that. Okay, so let's talk about ultrasound.
Yeah, look, being in FOMED, it's hard not to become an ultrasound evangelist, let's call it. But I really had no experience with ultrasound at all, whatsoever. But going to Nepal, knowing that this was an antenatal care and family medicine kind of clinic, and that they really didn't have any ultrasound resources there, I kind of started prepping up on my ultrasound skills, reading a lot, watching a lot of videos. FOMED was just a huge, huge factor of that education there. Spent a bit of time being mentored by a few sonographers, senior sonographers at a few maternal fetal medicine units around Sydney. And in the end, Sonosite actually ended up donating a secondhand machine, which I raised a bit of money for. And so I took over an old Sonosite 180.
Wow.
And that was just a game changer.
Yeah. Did they even have ultrasound at that clinic before you went?
They had an ultrasound come through, okay. But it was donated by an American charity and later broke and they didn't have the password for it.
Ah, okay.
The typical...
So they had it, but...
The typical case of aid from, you know, first world countries to third world countries. It works and then it doesn't and then you're stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, at least you were able to bring that capability back to the region.
Yeah, it was... just when I say it was a game changer, I mean, you know, going from a fetal heart rate monitor, which is literally just a fancy stethoscope, to, you know, being able to screen for placenta previa and amniotic fluid indexes and look at fetal growth rates. I mean, the obstetrics, gynecology, fetal medicine stuff you can do with ultrasound, basic ultrasound. We're not talking about, you know, neonatal cardiac stuff. Just basic screening is out of this world. Yeah.
And I mean, for that region, that must have been absolutely amazing, having gone from not having that capability to having that capability again.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it amazes me what a difference it made, being able to refer someone with probable placenta previa on to the district hospital, which was at least an hour and a half away.
I think that's something in this country we don't quite realise we're incredibly lucky to have.
Absolutely.
A lot of the time I get the yellow card from a patient, it says, you know, this patient's at risk of placenta previa or on previous births they've had a PPH or something like that. I mean, just knowing that going into it knows that, you know, maybe if they're really close to giving birth, maybe this is a birth that I don't want to stay on scene and try. This is a birth where I really want to get them into the hospital.
Absolutely.
That without that being a possibility, I can imagine my job would be quite different.
Yeah, I mean, my first day they're actually looking at an ambulance that came in. I mean, we talk about pre-hospital care in the developing world, and it is just a world away. We're talking about a truck fitted out with a cushioned seat and a tank of humidified oxygen, maybe a bandage in the corner. That is pre-hospital care in Nepal at the moment.
Wow.
Yep. It's interesting, to say the least.
I can totally understand that. What about the metro areas? Are they virtually the same, or do they run a more traditional EMS paramedic model?
Yeah, I didn't actually get a chance to have a thorough look in the capital city at their EMS system.
Okay.
But at the same time, I can't imagine it would be much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, if you read through Benjamin Gilmore's fantastic book, Paramedico, I don't know if you've touched on that.
Big fan of Benj Gilmore. Yeah.
Oh, you can read about some of the amazing EMS systems he's visited.
Absolutely.
My favourite one was the I think it was the the Viennan system, where they operate in boats.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine responding by boat?
That, I have to say, I'm slightly jealous of his experiences touring the canals in Venice, you know, in a speedboat. That seems pretty awesome.
It does. I mean, that's the ultimate way to respond, isn't it?
You know what? If you're going to do it in a style, you might as well do it in a speedboat, let's be honest.
Sometimes I wish I could just flip over people that were getting in my way, but on the water, that is actually possible.
It is absolutely...
Not that I would encourage flipping over
absolutely
anyone
not.
Getting in your way. Downstairs Care Out There podcast does not endorse anything that I say.
Important disclaimer, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Now on to ultrasound again.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about Sonowars at Smack Gold.
Oh,
coming back to
go
Smack
for
Gold.
It.
How did you feel about Sonowars?
Mate, I absolutely loved it. It was just phenomenal. First off, you've got pioneers in foamed ultrasound there. I mean, Matt and Mike from the Ultrasound Podcast, you know, they are the gods of FOMED ultrasound, really. And, you know, supported by our Australian team, not only that, but innovative education, you know, up there with a clay model of a heart, being able to cut it into its different axes and show people within the space of an hour how to do basic ultrasounds.
I mean, that was amazing, because I went into that knowing how to use ultrasound to evaluate lungs and how to use it to gain peripheral IV access.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about any of the more complex, even though they're basic ultrasound techniques, I knew nothing about those. And I came out of it still able to retain that information, and I still have a fairly good grasp of how each thing works and what kind of anatomy you're looking at when you look down an ultrasound.
Absolutely. I think we're both on the same page here. It was just fantastic. Yeah.
Okay, so after Nepal, was it on to Israel?
Yeah, so spent those 3 weeks in Nepal, had just the best experience of my life, working basically as a solo clinician there, in tandem with the local healthcare team. Just a phenomenal experience. And then off to Israel, yeah. So Israel has their national ambulance service, Magen David Adom, which is the Red Crescent Society ambulance service in Israel. And they have a youth program where, and they're the only ambulance service in the world that does this, between the ages of 18 and 25 especially, that's their kind of target market. You go over there, they put you through a 10-day first responder course, and then you go in the ambulance for 6 weeks.
Wow.
It is wow, yeah.
That's amazing. And I mean, over there, what did that first responders course cover for you?
So the first responder course over there would basically be the equivalent of first responders in the Australia or the States. Blood pressures, PHTLS, administering sublingual aspirin. They don't have any drugs on board the basic life support cars. They have a two-tier system there, basic life support and advanced life support.
Okay.
The basic life support, the ambulance is called a Lovan, a white car, and you've got a driver who's the senior clinician, and then so the driver is paid and a volunteer in the back who's a first responder or an EMT level.
Okay. So how does that work? So the senior clinician is still a basic like you, but...
So the scope of practice is you've got first responders,
yep.
EMTs, and paramedics. Then there's also an intermediate EMT who, working under a paramedic, can assist them with a whole range of pharmacology, but as a solo clinician just works at the EMT level. EMTs can do basic pre-hospital trauma life support. They can establish IVs, cannulate, and give 1 liter of normal saline before having to basically stop treatment, because it's really only for those long distance transfers and hypothermic patients.
Wow, that's a pretty broad scope of practice for an EMT even.
It is. I have to say, the training and education they have is phenomenal. The first responder course training that I received in Israel over 10 days far surpassed any that I've received in Australia.
So in terms of what did you find were some of their tips and tricks for effective training?
The first thing was having really good on-road clinicians who, first of all, they're all Israeli, so they all speak Hebrew. Fluent in English is obviously very helpful when you're teaching a class of 18, 19, 20 year olds. So they got guys whose parents were from America mostly, and who had really good grasp of English to teach, and who had done extensive study, whether informal or formal, in anatomy and physiology. So when they were explaining concepts, they really had a solid grasp of what they were explaining. Lots of hands-on. It was very much hands-on and practical, and this is what you're going to see on road. Not only that, I thought it was fantastic the way they approached education. They got people from the service to come in and talk about actual issues you were going to get on road. So there was a 1 hour presentation from the National Society of Child Protection and Child Abuse, and they came in and talked to us about working safely with children, not only as a clinician to a patient, but also as volunteers from overseas working with professionals, where you've obviously got a lot of young people in their late teens and early 20s coming through working with quite senior clinicians between around 20 to 45 years old on ambulances. And there is, of course, the risk when you've got that different dynamic that, you know, things are not necessarily going to be as appropriate as you would hope. And so they really take an absolutely proactive approach there, which I have to say was so nice to see. I haven't seen that in Australia.
That is absolutely amazing. It sounds like they've really tailored their first responders course to the end user, as opposed to just providing straight out of the textbook PHTLS. They've
absolutely
actually tacked some valuable information onto it that you can really use.
Absolutely. I mean, they write a textbook specifically for you. You have to memorize about 300 words in Hebrew, and you're tested. It's a really rigid test. It has an 80% success rate, this test, to pass the course. So this isn't just, you know, a pay to experience. This is, throughout the course, it's stressed that you will be dealing with life and death situations. You know, the general EMS staff, people's life will be in your hands, blah, 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 etc. You know, we've heard it before.
Yeah, saving lives, stamping out disease.
Absolutely, you know. But if you can't perform, you're not allowed on road. So absolutely huge respect for them. It's a developing/developed country. You can go from the main city where you've got a $1 billion diamonds training center to, you know, an hour and a half out and you're in the middle of the desert and, you know, you're dealing with Bedouin tribes or people in not a great financial situation. Interestingly enough, there's a huge influx of refugees. Israel just had 60,000 refugees from Eritrea and Sudan come into their main city, Tel Aviv, which is not a big city. It's a city of about 3 million people in something the size of half of Sydney.
Wow.
Israel's a small country. You can fit it about 40 times into the state of New South Wales.
Wow.
It's a tiny country, but there is such... talking about diversity, I'm working on an ALS unit, which is called a Natan, Niyedet Tipul Nimratz, which is mobile intensive care transport. There's a paramedic who can intubate. I mean, the drugs they have are absolutely fantastic. You have to know, I was such a fan. First off, they have ketamine. We're a big fan of ketamine here.
Yep, we often talk about ketamine. I mean, I'm excited that my service has it now, but I'll be even more excited once I get to use it.
Absolutely, yeah. So they're doing medication-facilitated intubations with ketamine.
Wow.
Yeah, they've got tranexamic acid.
Wow.
They have dopamine. They can do dopamine drips. They have really a huge amount of meds on the ALS units that are just fantastic.
That's amazing. I want to just take you back for a minute to when you were talking about being an hour and a half out of the city and dealing with the Bedouin tribes. In the Australian context, obviously, we don't have that. If you go an hour and a half out of our city, you're pretty much still in the city.
Yeah.
Given the traffic on that particular
day. Yeah, for sure. You can go an hour and a half and get nowhere.
Well, you can go an hour and a half and still be at Kingsgrove. But how did you find that affected your transport of those people? Was there a difficulty in dealing with transporting people what would be a relatively long distance for them?
Working mostly in a metro region, I was working in the center of Tel Aviv, which is the party city. It's the equivalent of Sydney, basically.
Okay.
I didn't get a huge amount of extended transport times. Some of my colleagues who were working in more regional stations did. In fact, some of my colleagues actually did cross-border transports where they'd be tasked with missions to go across the border into Gaza in an armoured ambulance, pick up a sick kid from a little hospital on the border, have a military escort, and then bring them back into one of the top hospitals in Israel, which was really quite a really nice experience, actually, to see that the medicine and the medical fraternity, EMS, nursing, doctors in Israel, just to put it out there, the senior clinicians on half my shifts were Arabic, Lebanese, Christian. You know, there's no hierarchy. The stuff you see on the news just isn't a concern in Israel.
Wow. That's amazing. Going across border in an armored ambulance to pick up someone. I mean, that's something that we'd never experience in Australia. Probably something that
not.
We never think of as being something that EMS would have to do. I mean, over in America, they've got their tactical EMS, which are, you know, they're more combat orientated
and placed paramedics,
with placed with sheriff departments and things like that, and with a tapered course based on gunshot wounds and trauma like that. But we really don't think of just your bog standard clinician having to even do that. Whereas that's a reality over there.
about a
especially
court,
for volunteer yeah. first responders.
Well, that's
I mean.
The thing. I mean, 80% of the entire, I guess, I wouldn't say employees, but the workforce in Israel and the ambulances is voluntary. About of the 10 to 12,000 medics you have on the ambulances, greater than 8,000 are volunteers. Only about 1,200 are employed, which is pretty phenomenal that the entire ambulance service of the country relies on volunteers who happily give their time.
I mean, that system works in Australia somewhat, but a majority of our ambulance service is still a paid profession.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And you can't run an ambulance service like we have in Australia with the scope of practice and have volunteers. It's very difficult. ALS...
That's not putting down volunteers. I mean,
not at all.
The volunteer ambulance officers that I've interacted with do an amazing job. And
these
are people that'll wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go out and deal with a person with a suspected myocardial infarction. And then they'll go home. They won't get home until 4 o'clock in the morning, and they'll be up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go and do their farm work.
We have phenomenal volunteers in Australia, but you can't have someone on a part-time basis and have the clinical governance to let them do medication facilitated RSIs, give really complex drugs. It's just not feasible when you're not constantly practicing those high fidelity skills, in my opinion. The basic life support stuff, absolutely. Intermediate life support, absolutely. But when you start to get to that advanced and intensive care life support stuff that you're getting in really high-end DMS, it's probably not practical, especially with a big service stretched over a country, to have volunteers performing at that really peak level.
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, they're just not getting the exposure to the skills.
Yeah.
And time again, studies have shown, and every month now a new study comes out on paramedic intubation that says, yeah, maybe we're not so good at it.
Absolutely. Getting back to the kind of diversity in the culture in Israel, it was, probably put it this way, a quarter of the course was spent on mass casualty incidents, terrorist attacks, pre-hospital trauma, life support. Every ambulance has a grey bag, which is our mass casualty bag. Every ambulance has at least 100 triage tags, mass casualty vests. Every single ambulance is equipped to be a first responder to a mass casualty incident, which is something you don't have in Australia.
No. I mean, here we rely on our mass casualty kits often arrive with a supervisor.
For sure.
We have probably 80 triage tags in the vehicle at a given time, and we do have a disaster bag.
Yeah.
But I can't say I've ever seen one of those cracked open.
Yeah, so on a regular basis, we're called to bomb standbys, I guess you'd say. So I remember one of my nights, quite a cold, wet night. I was sitting there in the ambulance for 2 hours as the bomb squad and their fantastic little robot disarmed a bomb by the roadside. I'm on my on Facebook posting, thank God I've got some Nutella, sitting here starving. Probably shouldn't have done it at the time. My grandma sent me a message two minutes later saying, oh my God, are you okay? The perils and joys of EMS in a different country, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. And that's just another thing is tips and tricks for new beginners. Always keep something in your shift bag that you can get to, that you can eat.
Absolutely. That was something I learned the hard way.
Yeah, I mean, we do standbys here at fire scenes, and we'll do a standby at a psychiatric patient while we wait for police to arrive.
For sure.
You can't go anywhere. You're trapped in the ambulance with your partner, and you've got to basically rely on what you've got.
Yeah.
I'm quickly becoming known as the food guy at big incidents.
You're the snacks guy.
Well, I'm the guy that'll crack out the packet of beef jerky the box of... The box of muesli bars at the end of a big call and throw it at everyone while we all sit down and do the paperwork, have a chat and clean up.
Well, thank you for that.
I'm just doing my part for the profession, really.
That's so selfless.
No, it is.
Fantastic. I have to say, interesting patient demographic as well. Israel has a very large geriatric population. Most of our nights were spent being called to Nana who fell over. We're talking just a huge geriatric population locked away in apartments. It's actually almost upsetting. In terms of demographics, I think only Japan has a larger elderly population than Israel. So a lot of our calls, especially nighttime calls from about 12 o'clock onwards, were mostly to small apartments where you have a couple or a single inhabitant with a serious medical problem, which was, I guess, an interesting experience. Definitely character building, 100%. Your entire night being spent with really sick. I mean, you know, on the brink of crashing, COPD, CHF, lungs that just froth. It was, yeah, very much a crucible, I guess you could say.
Wow. And what's their culture like over there? Do they, are they the kind of people that wait a long, long time to call the ambulance? Or are they, like around where I work, people will call the ambulance quite early. So our COPDers are in distress, but they're not at that point of respiratory failure, and they're not at that point of tiring, you know, and we're able to treat them quite quickly and effectively, and essentially deliver a stable patient to the ED for some follow up and some ongoing care.
I guess similar to there's certain things about EMS that you're going to see around the world, where you get that stratification in terms of socioeconomic class. The higher your socioeconomic class and status, the more likely you are to call early, in my opinion. That's really what I did see, especially in the migrant and refugee community. They would leave things quite late. And it's interesting because they were actually given free healthcare by the state. They don't pay at all for their ambulance transports. But I remember transporting a man with a rigid, distended abdomen who hadn't been able to pass solids for 2.5 weeks and just writhing in pain on a street corner. And things like that, massive COPD, edematous legs that were weeping. You know, a lot of people really did leave it late, and generally they were from lower socioeconomic circumstances, which was unfortunate.
Yeah.
I guess that health literacy really plays into it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's... I don't mind taking care of any patients. I take all comers, but those ones where people have waited quite long with a sick patient...
It's upsetting.
They're the ones that really get to me.
Yeah, it's upsetting. You almost... You definitely aren't angry or frustrated at them. You just wish they would have called earlier.
Yeah, and I mean, especially when the patient has a bad outcome, you really...
It's upsetting.
You wanted a good outcome. Yeah. You always want a good outcome.
For sure. For sure. And there we go, our signature ambulance in the background.
There we go. As you can tell, this is live and unedited.
It was just a phenomenal experience. The paramedics there, the education they undergo is really world class, and they don't have all the resources that we'd necessarily be used to in Australia. The ambulances aren't as clean and high tech. The monitors, I have to say, are fantastic.
So what monitor do they use over there?
They use, now let's see if I can remember what it was. They use the Core Plus 2 monitor.
Okay.
Which I have to say, having used now for 6 weeks, I'm a massive fan of.
Wow.
You can disassemble the monitor, so you've got the defibrillator and battery pack on one side. You've got the monitoring, module attached to the patient, which you kind of slip behind the pillow. It's very small, about 0.5 kilo, about the size of 2 fists. And then you've got the screen, which is detachable, and you can pop on the patient's lap or keep on your side, and it's all Bluetooth connected.
I mean, that's like the systems they have up on the wall in hospitals.
Absolutely.
Where they pop and go whatever modules they need.
For sure.
So for their acute beds, they've got, you know, BP, SpO2, and an ECG, whereas for their resus beds, they can really get everything. They can run a 12 lead off that monitor.
On a regular basis, there's end tidal on every single ALS monitor. ECG...
Just a huge win.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge win.
Getting end tidal on every monitor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a standard of care, let's be honest. It's upsetting to see that ambulance services around the world don't all have end tidal when they're doing intubations.
I actually, quite recently, I was talking to an American EMT who was telling me about his intubations and saying that they don't even mandate even colorimetric.
Oh, wow.
Entitled CO2.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been the standard in Australia for quite a while. That's what we routinely use on most ambulance services.
Yeah, that colometric.
In Australia is the colometric. Mm. I mean, that's been around since the 80s.
And
everyone's been using that for quite a long time.
Absolutely.
But now we've got a better device, and it was just upsetting to hear this guy telling me we don't even have colometric. I'm like, well, how do you confirm your tube? You can auscultate, but...
Yeah, I guess it's upsetting to see when the standard of care isn't able to be upheld because of cost prohibitive factors. You know, EMS is really moving in a great direction. I'd very much like to see EnTidal being used on non-invasive patients being self-ventilating, I guess. But hopefully we'll see that in the next few years.
Well, that's it. I was also talking to someone else who worked on the other side of America and was saying that they have a small orange piece that's included in all their basic life support kits. Now, basic life support don't use EnTidal capnometry, but it's included on their BVM, and they are told to attach it in line so that when the paramedic practitioner arrives,
right,
that orange tab is there to remind them to hook up.
That's fantastic.
The entitled, and they're trained to prompt that paramedic, would you like me to hook up the entitled CO2 whenever they're performing an intubation.
What a great human factors initiative.
I mean, just put as many people as you can in charge of getting that one patient-centered procedure done.
Absolutely. Kudos to them. That's fantastic to hear.
Yeah. I mean, that's really just addressing a training issue that then filters down.
Absolutely.
And that pressure going, you know, someone coming up going, would you like me to hook up the end title?
It's a graduated assertiveness.
It's very easy to say, yes. Yep. Yes, I would like you to hook up the
Absolutely.
Entire while you're there.
On the flip side, the BLS units don't have any monitoring. They've got manual BP cuffs.
They have manual BP cuffs?
Yeah, no pulse oximetry.
Okay.
But funnily enough, there was actually no situation where I wanted pulse oximetry.
Okay.
And I didn't have it. You know, it wouldn't have affected clinical decision making, you know. Yep.
So you were diagnosing clinically as opposed to off the screens?
Well, I mean, when you've got a COPD patient, you know that they need to get to hospital quick and they need oxygen.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really change your outcome.
Only little bits.
When a transport time is 7 minutes. And you're on a BLS unit with basically just oxygen therapy, you're quite restricted in what you can do, and the clinical decision making is fairly straightforward. It's obviously on an ALS unit where you have that broader scope.
Yeah.
SpO2 definitely plays into it.
Absolutely. Especially when you're doing drug-facilitated intubations or airway management.
For sure. Yeah, so that was just fantastic. Another thing that Israel does really well is training and simulation.
Yep.
While I was there, they had a mass casualty incident.
Ah, this is what I wanted to talk to you about.
Yep.
This is the reason you're here.
The coolest simulation I have ever seen. It was a national simulation where they took over half of Ben Gurion Airport, which is the only international airport in Israel. They flew in an Airbus A380, I think it is.
Wow.
One of the really big ones. And they loaded the entire plane with smoke machines.
This is taking simulation to the next level.
You talk about high fidelity simulation.
This is going beyond simulation. This is an actual event, really.
It really was.
Really, suspending that disbelief.
You know what? There is... I will never forget the sight of seeing a single file line of 500 ambulances. You know, every army ambulance, ambulances pulled from every single district and region around the state, all to this one airport. The army. I mean, this was a plus $3 million simulation. They had the airport, the army, the police, the media. They pulled spare ambulances from every single region. They have at the airport, because it's a fairly central location within the country, about 200 to 300 standby ambulances ready with equipment in the case of mass casualty. It was just phenomenal. Yeah. Watching, you know, 500 soldiers with triage tags come off an aeroplane, lie down. The triaging system they have is fantastic. Your ambulance has a number, obviously. You pull up to the patient allocation area, about 15 ambulances at a time. The patient allocator, who's a senior clinician, allocates you one patient on a stretcher and about 3 to 5 patients who sit on the bench in the ambulance, pop them into the ambulance, drive another 300 meters, where you come to an hospital and facility allocation manager who has an iPad linked into the entire system, and depending on your patient, will allocate you to a specific hospital. So the hospital has a list. They know constantly live who is coming to them, and they can monitor how many beds each hospital has free. It is just awesome.
Wow. I mean, that's something that we haven't even come close to anywhere. I've not even heard of that system before.
It's a specifically designed system, and they need it because mass casualty incidents are a specific concern and risk in Israel.
Oh, look, obviously. And that's really taking the whole of healthcare model to the next level. I mean,
oh,
you're
for
not,
sure.
And it makes it easier for the allocation manager because they're not on the phone constantly to facilities going, how many more patients can you accept that are a major trauma? How many more minors can you accept?
Absolutely.
How many,
Absolutely.
It really frees them up when they've just got that live feed right there on the iPad that they can look at.
Yeah, and so you're then allocated to the hospital, you drop the patient off at the hospital, and then you go back and, recommence the entire process, get allocated different patients, go to different hospitals. Even better than that, at two of the main hospitals in Israel, they have ghost hospitals, which is underground, about a 200 to 300 bed facility that is set up with all the equipment, all the medications, everything in date, and it's literally a ghost hospital that's ready as a surge flow, or if worst case scenario, the hospital on top is bombed.
Wow. So
they just have, surge facilities like you wouldn't imagine.
That's amazing. I mean, and you were saying they have 200 to 300 ambulances on standby at the airport, ready to go constantly.
So they're not manned, but
they are obviously just the money and the logistics turnover for something that may or may not be used is just a huge outlay.
For sure, absolutely. And I mean, we're not talking about a very well financed service. This is a service that relies almost solely on donations from overseas and on volunteers. They're only sponsored about 3% of the ambulance service budget comes from the government.
Wow.
Most of it is.
But I mean, it sounds like they're ready for what they have to deal with.
Absolutely. They're ready with what they have to deal with. Instead of an ambulance being decommissioned, it's repaired enough that it can be an unmanned vehicle at the airport.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There we go. That's brilliant. I mean, I was sure. I didn't even know about this ghost hospital idea. That's a 300-bed surge unit in the event of mass casualty would be game-changing.
It's preparation, and it makes the difference, doesn't it?
Doesn't it really? I mean, wow. That's just... There's preparation, and then there's building another hospital under your hospital.
And the way they train for mass casualty incidents, every week there's another mass casualty incident training in some region or some state.
Wow.
I know when I was there, we were involved with the Mexican Red Cross who'd come over to do training and simulation. They usually get the army involved as patients. Everyone is so fluent with triaging and mass casualty treatment. There's basically only three therapies that occur in an MCI. That's tourniquets and bandaging, needle thoracostomies, and diesel. And that's basically it. From a BLS perspective, we go in, and if there's a chest injury, we put an Asherman seal on it.
Yep.
If there's bleeding, we put a bandage on it or a tourniquet. And we transport.
Yep.
The paramedics come in and they don't transport, they stay on scene.
Oh, and perform interventions.
And they perform interventions. So they can go around and just do thoracostomies.
Look, that's a really good way to use your paramedic resource at a mass casualty, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, not tie them to transporting.
Absolutely.
Because when you send them away, you've lost them for however long
it
takes.
That's the thing. Another really great thing is the first responder network in Israel. So, right, so... Another really interesting part of, I guess, my Israel experience was just the culture. It's a very different culture. I survived off pita, hummus, and meat slices, basically.
I think that can be said for Liverpool, if anything,
that
the food is awesome and diverse.
Mm.